Talking History, and Happy New Year. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. It's the holiday season, and many of us have been, or will be, enjoying some fine food and drink, including wine. Our guest this week, Patrick McGovern, is an historian of wine, or to be more specific, an archaeologist who has studied the origins of viniculture. We will talk about what he's discovered on this special New Year's program. And after that, in one final tribute to the 50th anniversary of the Korean War, Ira Chernus looks at the truce that ended that war, but not all of the issues that gave rise to it and that continue to plague us today. But first, Joey Skidmore takes us back to an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on December 29, 1890, at Wounded Knee Creek, Pine Ridge Reservation, South Dakota, between 150 and 300 Lakota men, women, and children were killed when 500 soldiers of the 7th Cavalry opened fire. The event, known as the Massacre at Wounded Knee, marked the end of the Indian Wars. Many believe that the massacre resulted from the Ghost Dance movement, which began in the late 1880s when an Indian holy man had a vision that the old earth would be destroyed, and a new one created in which Native Americans could live as they had done before the arrival of the white man. It began as a peaceful movement, but its message became violent when followers such as Kicking Bear called for the complete destruction of white men. When the religion spread, reaching Sitting Bull's Lakota Nation, U.S. officials grew alarmed and ordered his arrest. Sitting Bull was killed in the process, while others fled to the Pine Ridge Agency. They were intercepted by the U.S. Cavalry at Wounded Knee, and when some in the group resisted their being disarmed, the cavalry opened fire. In 1973, members of the American Indian Movement returned to Wounded Knee, where they demanded a review of all Indian treaties and protested the government-sanctioned Lakota tribal government. Two protesters were killed, 12 injured, and over 1,200 arrested.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, a series of recent news articles has raised the specter of ruthless art thieves rapidly stripping cultural sites of precious artifacts and selling them to smugglers and dealers who hawk them in the West. No, they aren't talking about Iraq, although it has recently had its historical treasures pillaged as well, but China. Archaeologists like to joke that the ransacking of temples and other ancient sites is the world's second oldest profession. But what used to be a trickle of plundered treasures is apparently becoming a flood. As Catherine Tubbs, conservator of the Institute of Archaeology at the University College of London, put it, it's commonly accepted by those of us who work in the field that 80% to 90% of the material on the market is illicit. And on a more pleasant note, a German research team has unraveled the mystery of how the ancient Egyptians mummified their dead. Chemists from Tübingen University and the Derner Institute replicated an ancient treatment of cedar wood, which was used to treat the mummies, and found that it contained the long-sought chemical preservative. This is Talking History.
A grand old painter died last night. His painting's on the wall. Before he went, he bade us well.
The history of civilization is in many ways the history of wine. Wine, of course, is many things. It's a splendid drink, to be sure, but it's also a means of social interaction, a means of entertaining people, a political currency, and more. So what are the origins of wine? When was it first created? By whom and how? That's the subject of a new book by our guest this week, Patrick McGovern, titled Ancient Wine, The Search for the Origins of Viniculture. Patrick McGovern is a molecular archaeologist, a senior research scientist at the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology, and an adjunct professor of anthropology at the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome, Patrick.
Good evening, Brian.
Let's start with, how'd you come to be interested as an archaeologist now, not as a consumer, in the origins of wine?
Well, it really started by somebody coming to me with an unusual sherd from Iran that had a reddish residue on the inside and asking me if I would do an analysis of that. She was very convinced, this is a woman named Jenny Babler, that she had a wine jar dated to about 3000 BC.
So a shard is a piece of pottery.
Right, a piece of a large jar that would have contained probably about 10 liters originally.
Okay. And how did you take? Where'd you go from there?
Well, we were very skeptical because this is a 5,000-year-old vintage that she was proposing that we could analyze for. And in our experience, a lot of these organic compounds, you know, wouldn't stay around that long. But we had worked on something called royal purple, which was one of the most famous dyes in antiquity, where we had very well-preserved purple going back about 3,000 years. And so we gave it a shot with the sherds from Iran.
Now, you pushed the origins of viniculture back quite a ways from people who used to think it was maybe 2,000 or 3,000 years, and now you've got it back to about 8,000 years ago. And what evidence do you have for this?
Well, this has all been, you know, built up over time as we've done more and more vessels, you know, from different parts of the Near East and Egypt. What we're basically doing is looking for fingerprint compounds that tell us that a grape is present, a grape product. You know, it could be grape juice, vinegar, or wine. And the principal compound that we're looking for is tartaric acid, which is found in grapes in fairly large amounts. And it's very characteristic of grapes in the Middle East. I mean, so there's no other natural source that can really account for tartaric acid other than grapes if you find it in the Middle East.
And how do you differentiate that, let's say, it rather being grape juice or wine? How do you tell the difference?
Well, there is a... where we get into sort of an archaeological argument, because we can't, you know, demonstrate absolutely that we have, you know, any one of these grape products. But if you have a jar in which it has a fairly narrow mouth and you can argue that it was used for a liquid, that would have, and you can show that it had a large component of grape, so you have some sort of a grape juice, that will start to ferment very quickly, especially in a hot climate. In the first few days, and you'll start to get the grape juice turning to wine because there's yeast on some of the grape skins. So that'll happen naturally. Then the real issue is how do you keep, you know, that wine that's going to be produced quite naturally from turning into vinegar. And there's that's where we really developed a whole, you know, set of thought and scientific evidence that would point to it, you know, being intentionally preserved. For instance, you will find clay stoppers that fit into the mouths of these vessels, and this clay acts a little bit like cork. They didn't have cork in those days, but the clay will absorb the liquid and expand and then keep out oxygen that would cause it to go to vinegar. Then the other argument that we use to make a case for wine rather than vinegar is that most of our ancient samples have a tree resin that's been added to the wine intentionally, and this would help to keep the wine. The only country today that actually uses this method is Greece, where you have a wine called Retsina. It's kind of an acquired taste, you know, but in antiquity, we have evidence that tree resins were being added regularly to the wines.
And that was used to preserve them?
That would have helped in preserving them because there's antioxidant properties in the tree resin. And the tree resins actually are used in combination with wine in many of the ancient medicines, too, from Egypt and Mesopotamia.
Oh, interesting. All right, now, you found the origins of wine, or I don't know if we've been correct using that term, perhaps we should say a fermented beverage that contained grapes, occurring nearly simultaneously in two parts of the world, which were really quite distant from one another, the Caucasus of Georgia and in China. And there's no real evidence that they had any contact with one another. So is this really a matter of two peoples at great distance not talking to one another, stumbling on the same idea at roughly the same time?
Well, we think, that each of these cultures in East Asia and Western Asia are developing about the same time. You know, they're starting to domesticate different plants and animals. There's village life being developed. There's still a big issue about what kind of communication was going on across Central Asia. And, you know, we can't be sure that there's any direct communication. There may be, sort of piecemeal spread of ideas from, place to place. And so if you get, one group of people in Western Asia starting to experiment with different plants and domesticating them, and that just that idea somehow is, spread in other areas and eventually makes its way across to China, they would start experimenting with the plants that they have there. There are going to be different kinds of plants. Grape is one of those plants, though, that is actually common to both areas, although it's different species that we're talking about. But, I would think that it's some kind of an independent invention in both of those areas. It just happens to occur about the same time because they're developing at about the same rate, and, they have access to, a range of plants that they can actually start to domesticate and that are sugar-rich enough to make into a fermented beverage.
Okay, well, let me pick up on that species reference and go to what I think is an even more interesting point. And you suggest in your book that 99% of the wine in existence today sort of comes from the same subspecies of wild grape. What's the grape? Where did it grow 8,000 years ago, and how did it come to dominate the world?
Well, the grape is Vitis vinifera, and then the subspecies is Silvestris, which is the wild plant. It's also called the Eurasian grape. It actually exists in the wild form, although it's being rapidly wiped out because of development, all the way from Spain across to Central Asia. But the area where it has its greatest genetic variability and is therefore sometimes called the world center of the grape is in the upland area that sort of encompasses eastern Turkey, Transcaucasia, Georgia, Armenia, and then across over into northwestern Iran. And that's where we have the earliest archaeological evidence of some form of what I call a wine culture developing, in which you would have had the domestication of the grape, the Eurasian grape, occurring.
And you had it just in that one location, but then you suggest that it was transported to and transplanted to other parts of the world, even though the grape grew in many different locations. You suggest this is what, the Noah hypothesis?
Well, yes. I mean, we can call it this idea that there's a single point, in time of domesticating of this Eurasian grape, probably around 6,000 BC, maybe even earlier, and refer to that as the Noah hypothesis. It's a little bit similar to, you have what's called the Eve hypothesis, where you try to trace human origins back to Africa and a single mother. There's a lot of debate about that. Well, the parable of Noah you could take as illustrating a similar kind of first domestication for the grape, because Noah, when he got off his ark on Mount Ararat, the first thing he did actually was, according to the story, was to plant a vineyard and make wine.
Right. Okay, get the connection.
But, whether we can actually prove, that there is a single domestication and where that occurred, that is, really ongoing research right now, looking at DNA evidence of modern wild and domesticated grape in these various regions, making comparisons, but then also looking at ancient DNA of grape and seeing if we can make comparisons with a specific region, and then dating, as best we can, when that earliest domestication could have occurred. You've also got to have some knowledge of horticulture to be able then to take that domesticated plant and actually move it from place to place, introduce it. So you take cuttings or roots or buds and you have to then transplant those to other regions. But it's just that one species, that Eurasian species, that then ultimately spread out, you know, around the world, you know, only reaching California maybe in the last 50 years in any measurable way. But there are many other species of grape, but so far we don't have any archaeological, chemical, or really botanical evidence that shows that they were domesticated at a very early date. And we don't even have, you know, clear evidence for the Eurasian grape that it was domesticated at an early date, say, in Spain. They really had to wait until there was an influence coming from the Near East, you know, and vines being transplanted sequentially, you know, across the Mediterranean, before we get really clear evidence that European viticulture, you know, starts to take off, and they start to develop their own wine cultures.
Now, your work is heavily interdisciplinary or multidisciplinary, however you want to put it, if you're not in particular engaged. But now you've got molecular biologists even involved. What are they adding to the conversation?
Well, this whole notion of how DNA, if we can take samples, you know, from ancient material, ancient seeds, grape seeds, extract the DNA and then make comparisons and isolate parts of the genome, you know, that is going to tell us whether it's domesticated and, you know, how the whole story really develops with the domestication and subsequent spread of viticulture from one place to another. There is actually, I mean, the big advantage of the domesticated grape is that it is hermaphroditic. That is, it has the male and female parts of the flower together. And so there's no problem with pollination by wind. I mean, the wild plant has separate male flowers and separate female flowers. So you actually have to get the wind or mechanically transfer the pollen from the male over to the female. In the domesticated Eurasian grape, they're right together in the same flower. So that assures a lot more fruit being produced. And then you can see that if you're going to have any sort of mass production of wine, I mean, the hermaphroditic domesticated grape is the way you want to go. And there is actually a gene that determines, you know, whether you get a male, female, or hermaphroditic individual grapevine. And if you were able to take ancient DNA from grape and identify that particular gene as being hermaphroditic, you can say then for sure that you've got a domesticated grapevine.
Okay. Well, now you and I could be sitting here, as I know you are, enjoying a glass of wine, but for the ancients, there were other reasons other than just the wonderful taste of wine for drinking it. Would you explain that a bit?
Well, I mean, it goes far beyond, you know, just all the sensory delights of wine, because it really is became a symbol. Of course, a religious symbol. I mean, we just have to look at our Western religions to see, you know, how important wine is. It's right at the center of each of our Western religions, especially as a symbol of blood. But then beyond that, especially among kings and the upper class, wine became a sort of symbol of conspicuous consumption, you might say. So, you know, after you had a great victory in war, or you killed the lion or hippopotamus, you would celebrate with a grand feast, at which wine would be the way that you really demonstrated that you were all powerful. And you had special drinking sets and so forth that you used to serve the wine. And these were then made as gifts from one king to another. So you had one king trying to imitate another, and of course, you know, bringing in the best wine, the best wine sets, and so forth. So, you know, slowly but surely, you get the upper class and the royalty especially interested in wine, so they start importing it. And then the next step is to actually bring in the grapevine and get a winemaking industry going. And that we can track, you know, from one place to another through time.
Were there also health reasons?
Well, then you also have the whole issue of medicine. Because, you know, before we had the development of, you know, modern synthetic drugs and so on, I mean, alcohol was one of the principal medicines. And I mentioned before, you know, tree resins in combination with wine. I mean, these are the two ingredients that go into much of ancient medicine, and for good reason, because, I mean, if you drank just water, you run the risk of picking up all kinds of microorganisms and getting sick. But if you drink a fermented beverage, such especially wine, which has a high alcoholic content, you're going to live longer, and you're probably going to reproduce a great deal more.
So there were lots of reasons for drinking wine to begin with.
Oh, I mean, I think it, you know, it's a social lubricant, it eases tensions. I mean, just like, you know, we come home from a hard day at the office, you know, in antiquity, you know, you're out working in the field all day, and if you didn't have your glass of beer at the end of the day, I mean, you know, you would definitely rebel against the pharaoh.
Makes sense to me. Well, we only have a minute left. Maybe you could just, in very brief form, could you sort of summarize how wine was made in the ancient world and how that might differ from the way we do it today?
Well, I don't know. You know, some of the best methods today probably, you know, are still using techniques that go back thousands of years. I mean, I just came back from a trip to northern Portugal where I went up the Douro River to the area where they make port wine. And they're still stomping the grapes up there. In fact, I even got into the vat and stomped the grapes, and you can make a very good case that the human foot is actually a lot better than any mechanical device. You don't actually break the seeds, you know, when you use a human foot, and that keeps, you know, very bitter tannin substances from getting into the wine. And, of course, aging in oak is something now that we have molecular evidence on Crete going back to 1700 B.C., or at least oak is in there, is, you know, in the jar that we analyzed. And, you know, then you get into a question of whether the treading vat was made out of oak, or did they, you know, age it in oak somehow. You know, like, another issue is leaving the juice or the must to ferment on the lees, you know, where you've got grape skins and yeast and so forth that can add special flavors. So, I mean, a lot of winemakers now are, you know, going back to some of these more traditional techniques and experimenting with them. I think that at the same time, you know, modern science has a great deal to tell us about, you know, how to make, you know, very consistent, delicious wines too, you know, in terms of the various kinds of fermentation processes, the yeast that are involved. But, you know, you need to still keep some of these traditional techniques, too.
Well, it's always good to have somebody on the show who gets into his work with both feet. And I hope you enjoy your glass of wine there. And thank you for joining us. It was very interesting.
Well, you know, when you sip that glass of wine, you're really recapitulating history, too.
Well, great. That's a good excuse. I'm going to go home and have one myself.
Okay.
You've been listening to Patrick McGovern, Senior Research Scientist at the University of Pennsylvania's Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology, and the author of Ancient Wine, The Search for the Origins of Viniculture, published by Princeton University Press. And this is Talking History. For our site of the week, following up on our guest Patrick McGovern, we'd like to direct you to the website he has created where you can learn much more about the ancient origins of wine. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Fiona Beatty.
Patrick McGovern, the author of Ancient Wine, The Search for the Origins of Viniculture, has put online the fruits of his labor, so to speak, at www.museum.upenn.edu. The site offers brief histories of wine in the Neolithic period as well as ancient Egypt and Mesopotamia, a description of the modern technology he employs in his work, the evidence he has gathered for the point of origin of viniculture, a map of the region where he believes wine originated, and some discussion of the chemical composition of the first wines. It also has an interactive quiz to test your knowledge of ancient wine. Find it all under exhibits at www.museum.upenn.edu.
And finally, we turn to our commentary of the week and the final commentary of the year, which marked the 50th anniversary of the end of the Korean War. Talking History regular Ira Chernus takes one last look at the truce that ended the war and what remains to be done to bring peace to the peninsula that remains divided and troubled 50 years later.
Renewed concerns about North Korea's nuclear weapons program are reviving memories of the Forgotten War, the war in Korea. But the real key to U.S. policy is the forgotten peace that began at the war's end 50 years ago. When the Korean fighting began, most Americans assumed that peace meant defeating our opponents unconditionally, whether their sign was a swastika, a rising sun, or a hammer and sickle. American troops were sent to Korea in the spirit of a crusade to vanquish the foe, but they came home in 1953 with only a tie. The armistice did bring total victory on the policy front in a battle fought here at home. The advocates of containing communism clearly defeated those led by General Douglas MacArthur, who demanded unconditional surrender, even if securing it meant using nuclear weapons. When President Eisenhower announced the armistice, he insisted that the U.S. had won in Korea, simply because it had stopped the enemy from winning. In the new policy of containment, victory did not mean eliminating threats, but merely preventing threats from eliminating us. The U.S. accepted the 38th parallel as a line dividing safety from danger in the Korean Peninsula and, by extension, throughout the world. As long as the sources of danger stayed on their own side of the global dividing line, the free world would consider itself at peace. U.S. foreign policy in Korea and around the world got stuck at that point. It remains stuck today. This past spring, North Korea announced its nuclear capability. The reaction of policymakers in the U.S. hardly admits the possibility of a constructive win-win resolution to the conflict in Korea. Instead, we have only the same old options, contain or crusade and conquer. After 50 years, it is time for the U.S. to move beyond the narrow options of containment and conquest to look for new approaches to genuine cooperative peace in Korea and all over the world.
You've been listening to Ira Chernus, Professor of Religious Studies at the University of Colorado at Boulder. Chernus's commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Service. And that brings us to the end of another week of Talking History. As always, we welcome your comments on this program or suggestions for future shows, which you can send us either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Joey Skidmore, producer. Fiona Beatty, assistant producer. To learn more about Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau, wishing you a Happy New Year.
One bourbon.